You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you've had a good week. I'm hoping that you listened to my episode on Wednesday with Leah McSweeney, who is the newest housewife on Real Housewives of New York. That show is hilarious. This season is like hitting that out of the park. It is so funny. This week's episode, prepare yourself. You are probably going to laugh so hard that tears pour out of your face. It's like one of those episodes. Another show that I've been watching that my friend Lindsay actually had suggested, it's on Netflix. It's called The Innocence Files. Now, let me just say, I think that people who love reality shows also love documentaries, docuseries, and most certainly they love true crime. So if you're a true crime person, this is right up your alley. The Innocence Files is about the Innocence Project, which unravels missteps and deceit in a series of wrongful convictions exposing the injustice inflicted on victims and on the accused. So if this is something that really gets you fired up, this is the show for you. And that is on Netflix. This episode, I'm really, really excited about. Personally, I think it's one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done. Marcus Lemonis and I have been in conversations about this interview for about 6 months now. And because of this pandemic, the guy finally has a moment to sit down and gave me the opportunity to interview him. And I think that you will find that what he says about his own life and then also the advice that he gives small businesses is so interesting and important. He's really an interesting guy. Now, CNBC used to be the channel where you would get breaking business stories. I used to pitch them all the time when I work with global law firms. And over the last couple of years, they've sort of reinvented themselves and they have a ton of great programming. The Profit is, I believe, the best show that they have. And like I said, it is hosted by this incredible self-made millionaire and serial entrepreneur named Marcus Lemonis. So he lends his expertise to struggling businesses in various industries across the country while using his famous people, process, product principle, the three P's. It's his mantra. He analyzes every business by the quality of people, whether they have an excellent and relevant product and the best possible process for creating, delivering, and selling that product. Since The Profit first premiered in July of 2013, he has invested nearly, they say $50 million of his own money. I'm going to say it's much more than that in the companies that have been featured on the series. And as a result of successful partnerships on CNBC's The Profit, Lemonis has added a variety of new product lines and services to his holding company, Marcus Lemonis Enterprises, LLC. He's really, really interesting. He was born in war-torn Beirut, Lebanon in 1973, and at 9 months old was adopted by a Lebanese and Greek couple living in Miami, Florida. And as a young child, he was exposed to positive and prosperous business values at his family-owned Anthony Abraham Chevrolet. His entrepreneurial spirit bloomed at age 12 when he started a lawn mowing service in order to generate money to open a candy business. He graduated from Christopher Columbus High School in Miami and moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to attend Marquette University, where he studied political science, criminology, and economics. He held several automotive sales and managerial roles. But it really was a conversation with family friend and former Chrysler CEO, Lee Iacocca, who advised him to get into the camping and RV business, which put him on the path to eventual chairmanship at America's number one source for RVs, camping accessories, RV maintenance and repair, Camping World, and Good Sam. He has been recognized by several outlets. Best in Business, Ernst & Young named him Entrepreneur of the Year. Prior to The Profit, he appeared on NBC's The Apprentice in 2001 and 2012 and was featured on ABC's television show Secret Millionaire in 2012. He is incredibly charitable. He drives results through collaborations, partnerships, and relationships. His advice for aspiring entrepreneurs is simple. Know your numbers, trust the process, and remember that he's 100% in charge. He is quite a character, a really kind person. And like I said, this has been one of my most favorite interviews that I've ever done. So here we go with Marcus Lemonis. Marcus Lemonis is the host of The Profit on CNBC. I have been stalking him for months. I finally tracked him down. I consider this to be a high achievement. When he isn't running his multi-billion dollar businesses, he's on the hunt for small businesses in which to invest time, care, and money. He can't invest in every small business, but he can teach a new generation of entrepreneurs some of the secrets to his success. It all starts with people, process, and product, the three P's. Marcus, welcome to the show.
By the way, I just want to clarify, the stalking is an understatement. I don't know if there's a word that supersedes stalking, but whatever it is, we're going to figure it out. But thank you for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
The best thing about you is you've got a great personal story. I'm totally fascinated by it. I relate to it. I love it. So born in Lebanon, adopted by an American couple 4 days after your birth. Adoptive parents were Greek Lebanese. While visiting the orphanage that you were adopted from, you found out that your birth name was Ricardo and your parents were Syrian. You're an immigrant and born in Lebanon of a Syrian mother. What was that experience like going back to the orphanage? And now do you feel more compelled to learn about your Syrian ancestry?
You know, I wasn't actually even sure I wanted to go. And when I sat down with CNBC and they floated the idea about doing this, I was a little suspect, not of them, but of the whole process. And you know, after being living for 46 years, I didn't really see the need to uncover something that I didn't have a lot of curiosity about. And when I finally decided to go, I made the decision to go largely because I want one of the things that I end up doing in my life, separate from, you know, the entrepreneurial stuff, is to become a face of adoption. To have people understand the blessing that it is and the challenge that it is, because it's both. I mean, yes, I'm grateful, but, you know, a lot of people struggle with the idea of being adopted. And so going back there and learning about what my name really was, and it's kind of funny because my friends now actually call me Ricardo. Ah. And after the documentary aired, I know, right? After the documentary aired, I was very conscious about, you know, taking out, covering up my last name in the episode, because I thought, you know, I don't know who my birth mother is. She is alive today. We know that for certain. I have not met her. I have no intention of meeting her. But I thought to myself about the grave responsibility of this whole process. And so I elected to not let people know what her name was, but I received probably no less than 2,000 emails.
Wow.
And text messages from random people that said, oh, we know who your mom is. We have information. People contacted my wife and on her social media and said those same things. And at the end of the day, It was good for me to do it. It was good for me to shine a light, use the platform that I've been generously given by CNBC, use that platform to bring light to the importance of three things. One is the importance of adoption and why it's needed. Two, the process of immigration and how it can be done the right way. And three, and maybe most importantly, is how grateful I am to be in this country where an orphan from a war-torn country can come here and pursue whatever dreams he or she has and to be welcomed with open arms. And I don't think enough people realize how great this place is that they would, you know, this country would allow you to do that. It's kind of cool.
And you also it seemed to be sort of torn when you spoke to people in Lebanon about your life, like the realization that you were so privileged. So I'm assuming that weighs heavily on you, even in your business, that extending a hand to somebody who needs it and knowing that to whom much is given, much, you know, should be given back.
I mean, it definitely has always been part of my ethos, right? To be a giver. But there's moments like everybody where selfishness kicks in, fear kicks in, self-confidence or lack thereof kicks in, and you revert back to bad behavior in business or in life. And I think this moment was decent for me because it probably, like, almost like a chiropractor, it rejiggered my back and my brain and sort of put me back on track. And that had only happened one other time to the extent, and that was when, oddly enough, when I did an episode of Secret Millionaire, which was in 2000, and I think it was 2008 that I did it. And it was probably the most pivotal thing that I had ever done because it really forced me to do a lot of soul searching. And I think this trip to Lebanon did as well, you know, being halfway across the world by myself. And it's always good for anybody, but particularly business people who get caught up in their day-to-day nonsense to do it. But it definitely changed me. And I don't know if I'm more curious or less curious. I haven't decided to find out more. Mm. Right at this moment today, as I'm talking to you, I'm less curious. But when I feel scared or I feel insecure or I feel, vulnerable, it tends to trigger, you know, my desire to learn more because you want to have some comfort in your life, you know, kind of odd.
That makes sense. I love the story of the beginning of your career. I mean, so your family has this very prosperous Chevrolet dealership. You've got this family connection to Lee Iacocca. Now, Lee Iacocca was worshipped in my childhood home. There was a crucifix on the wall and a picture of Lee Iacocca. Please tell everybody the story about growing up around automotive sales and what happened with your connection to Lee.
Well, you know what? I grew up in South Florida, Miami, and I'm definitely a Miami guy. And my family had this really nice car dealership, which is, you know, I mean, nothing special, but it was at the time a pretty big business in South Florida. And my grandfather had a personal friendship with Lee Iacocca, you know, going back years. And I always had known of him. I would go to family events or parties and he would be there. And we did a lot of charity stuff with St. Jude and he would come. And it was more of a distant relationship. But as I worked through my business career, or as I worked through my childhood, actually, you know, I went to high school in Miami and then I decided that I didn't like the weather and the beautiful people and the environment. So I decided to go to college in Milwaukee because, you know, Milwaukee's, you know, better weather, better people, better everything than Miami. And I laugh when I say that. But when I went to Milwaukee, it really centered me. Hmm. And the reason that I make that point in telling you about my story with Lee Iacocca is that I understood more about Middle America while I was in Milwaukee. And understanding more about Middle America and the values that I believe they possess and the way businesses are run, I understood a little bit more about what I didn't want to do. And I didn't want to go back into my family's car business right out of the gates. It just is a little edgy, and it was South Florida. And it was, you know, the 1980s and 90s when the drug community was big in South Florida and Miami Vice was on. And it was just too much for me. And I knew that I wanted to do something different. And so I ended up getting recruited by a guy who was connected to a publicly traded company called Recreation USA, which subsequently went bankrupt. And I got to that company through Lee Iacocca. And I was working at a company called AutoNation at the time. And I got a call from Lee Iacocca, who was on the board of this company, and said, hey, do you want to talk to me about a job? And I was like, you know, I work for this publicly traded company called AutoNation. I make a good living. I'm totally fine. I'm 27 years old. I'm making, you know, call it $300,000-$400,000 a year, which is like, you know, you won the lottery 10 times over. And he said to me, well, I'd like you to meet me. So I flew out to Bel Air, flew out to Los Angeles. I drove to his house. First time I had ever been to his house in Bel Air, right by the whatever that fancy hotel is, the Bel Air Hotel, which is where I got married. I went into his house and first time there, and I was shaking because I was so nervous, right? I had seen him from a distance and had known him from a distance. And it was an odd phone call to get, but when Lee Iacocca calls, you know, you don't say, I'm sorry, I'm busy. So I got on the plane and I walked into his house and he asked me to go into his library. And in his library, he had all these pictures of himself. And I thought it was really odd at first because I thought it was a bit narcissistic. At first, I didn't understand why. And he explained to me that the reason that he put those pictures on the wall is that they were in chronological order and it would allow him to understand where he started and where he what he accomplished through his life.
Wow.
And he looked at me and he said, so what's your story going to be?
Wow.
Because right now you're in the car business and, you know, big deal. What's your story going to be? And I said, you know, I don't really know. And he said to me, well, would you be interested in leaving the car business for the RV business? And I was like, I remember like seeing a Winnebago in my neighbor's yard. And unfortunately, as a kid, not being, as wise as we should be, I remember saying to my mom, like, oh, those farmers across the street, they have an RV. And so I got into the RV business because of him. And, you know, 20 years later, that's really if I think about tentpoles of who I am, that's really my backbone is my RV business called Camping World. And that's really, you know, what has made me who I am today professionally. It hasn't, you know, made me who I am personally, but it's definitely made me who I am professionally. And what a great opportunity to get, you know, instilled into it, to an industry. And he said to me, I want you to get into the RV business because people don't have to buy RVs like they do cars. They want to buy them. People are never going to want to stop going outside. And people are going to want to travel this country forever. It's not going to be a fad. It's not going to come and go. And it's a super fragmented industry. And you could end up becoming, as he said to me in quotations, the Lee Iacocca of the RV industry. And at the time, I was like, okay, I don't even know what this means. So I left my job to work for a company that he was on the board of. And it didn't last very long because the first day I got there, I found that they were insolvent. They were essentially out of business and I helped wind the company down, but I learned a lot. And the bankers that I helped get paid back put me into business in the company that I have today. They're like, if we trust you, we're going to put you in business. So, you know, the background of how I got there is good. I think what I always tell people is more interesting than that is why I got into the small business space. And most people don't know this about me, but part of the reason that I got into the small business space is because as a child, while I was super blessed with great parents, I struggled with a terrible eating disorder, really bad. I had attempted suicide twice. I had been molested by a family member, not my mother and father. And I wouldn't say I was fractured, but I was damaged. I was definitely damaged. And I would say that, you know, to anybody that has ever experienced any of those things, you don't ever become undamaged by it. My coping mechanism became helping other people who couldn't help themselves. Mm. Became my coping mechanism. And it manifested into something that I never would have expected. It manifested into that coping mechanism coupled with you know, a decent knowledge of numbers, and as my mother used to say, a very big mouth. And so when you put those three things together, the prophet is born.
And your show really is...
Big mouth, knowledge of numbers, and poetry.
But your show really is different from other shows because, in first of all, the spectrum of your audience is really wide, but you seem to focus your show like a curriculum where you and the audience are learning as you go. And also, you seem to have decided to invest money when the odds were not always perfect. So while other, and also other shows don't have a host that invests their own money, you are also doing that and doing investing in companies that you might not even see a profit for in the long run for quite some time.
Ever.
So I think that you are
really, or ever.
So I feel like you really stand alone that way. Why do you think there's so few, you're the only person that kind of has that perspective that the show really is like a curriculum?
Well, there's two things. You know, I have a funny sort of oddity about myself. I actually have a lot of them, but I have one that is my closet. And in my house in Chicago, my closet's in the basement. My wife's closet is the master, and that's a choice of mine. And the reason that I tell you that story is that in my closet, I have a wall of every lesson that I want to teach through this. I'm glad that you called it a curriculum because I do the same. I have a lesson that I want to teach to people. And as I pick episodes from casting, I definitely pick them based on trying to achieve crossing off certain lessons. And, you know, we've done over 100 episodes now. And there's still a lot left to teach. And there's more importantly, a lot more for me to learn. And selfishly, the curriculum is not just about what I want the viewer and the business owner to learn. It's what I want to learn about myself and what I want to learn about my capabilities and what I want to learn about myself when I make a decision and it's wrong. And when I make a decision and gamble on somebody when everybody says I shouldn't and it works out. And I really believe that if you said to me, what's the number one thing that you've gotten out of the show? It is truly a transformation of my own psyche. It has helped me build confidence. I don't usually surprise these people. I don't possess a ton of self-confidence. I have a lot of social anxiety about things. But I chose to put my own money in because I wanted people to know that somebody does care about the quote-unquote little guy.
Yeah,
and I always felt like the little guy. I always felt like the odd man out. And I always looked for somebody to fight for me. And I really never found anybody to do that for me. And I never felt like, you know, when I watch television, I hear about Fortune 100 companies. And when I watch business makeover shows and they slap paint on the walls or they throw pots and pans or they, you know, move that bus or whatever BS is out there. I wanted to change the narrative and I wanted to make reality television for business a much higher hurdle. Mm-hmm. And I've taken pride in the fact that you know, look, Shark Tank is in my opinion, the number one business show on television. It's got a very powerful primetime major network backing with unbelievably talented, I don't know if they call them co-hosts, investors. And I never really set them as a target of like, oh, I have to be bigger or better than that. I wanted to be my own person, but I definitely wanted to create separation between the profit and every other quote unquote business show by putting my own money up and having my own skin in the game and not having every episode end well. You know, you watch episodes and you're like, oh my God, this is a train wreck. How did he allow that to happen? Right. And I love the fact that my frailties and my mistakes and my misjudgments are on display.
Mm-hmm.
I actually am totally fine with the fact that when I make a mistake, people are like, damn, that was stupid. I'm like, yeah, I'm a human, just like you. Like, yeah. I don't have all the answers. So it's been good for me. It's been very cathartic. The whole process has been cathartic.
You're doing 20 episodes a year. You've said that a third of your year is spent on the show. It's about 6 days per episode. It's cool. It's a heavy commitment alongside your other business commitments. You've said that your businesses are in silos. People in those silos help run your businesses. Is it true that you don't have an assistant?
I don't. I need one, but I don't. And up until recently, I didn't have an agent or an entertainment lawyer or a publicist or any of those things because I didn't want to be that guy. I've never written a book because I didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
The reason that I pivoted, I know it's like crazy. The reason that I pivoted is that I realized the importance of if my ultimate goal is to change the narrative about the importance of fighting for the little guy slash gal, because I consider myself one of them. People argue with me about that. Then I need to figure out a way to get my message out.
Yeah.
And I've almost turned into this business model. This is going to get me in trouble. They've almost converted the business model into an evangelical business model.
Hmm.
And when I say that, what I mean by that, and I want to be very clear, is the importance of reaching as many people with the widest net with the understanding that I just need them to hear what I have to say, but my time and their time is limited. So I have to come in hot. I have to be very targeted. I have to find the right audience. I have to find the right voice. I have to do all those things. And I felt like I was really starting to stumble. I was getting overwhelmed by the number of businesses I had to run and overwhelmed by the amount of money I was spending and overwhelmed by the request to do things and overwhelmed by a lot of things. And I started making a lot of mistakes, like really bad mistakes, costly mistakes. I would do deals that I shouldn't and I would agree to things that I shouldn't. And I remember my wife, before I married her, said to me, like, you're supposed to be this like really smart business guy on television. You're doing some really stupid things.
That's what a spouse is for.
Yeah, we weren't married yet, so I'm not sure where she got the license, but she definitely picked up the license and took it. And she said to me, listen, if you really have this goal of transforming the way people think about people, then you're going to have to be more strategic. You're going to have to be more precise. You're going to have to be you're just going to be more precise about it. You can't just spray everything hoping it sticks. And I'll tell you a very embarrassing story. 3.5 or 4 years ago, I had already done the show for, call it 3.5 or 4 years, okay? And I had done maybe 60 episodes, and the show had, gotten whatever a cable show sort of recognition was. It was getting decent recognition, okay? And people knew it, and I would go places, and people knew it, and it was starting to become part of the zeitgeist, and there was nice articles written about it, and, whatever. The numbers were good, and et cetera. And it's been CNBC's number one show since 2013. Yeah, since 2013. And I remember the first time I finally started to take the Emmy nominations seriously. And we, you'd be on that list as a host or you'd be on that list as a show. And I remember telling people, because one thing that's a flaw of mine is that I do like to get not recognition, but validation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible flaw of mine. Like, I need validation. Maybe it's an only child syndrome where I need to be like, I needed my mom to tell me I was always, doing it right or doing it wrong. I like to be coached.
Yeah.
And I remember the morning, if you remember, the Emmy nominations used to come out like at 5 a.m, right?
Sure.
Really early.
Yeah.
And I remember being in my bathroom, getting up early. And I remember this was actually a really turning point for me. I remember crying like a baby when I didn't get nominated. I remember crying like a baby because I couldn't understand why small business wasn't getting recognized, except Shark Tank was nominated. And that's a perfectly excellent show about small business. And I remember saying to myself, okay, is it me? Is it the show? Do people not care? We're changing lives. We're changing the world. We're educating people. And I'm picking this next thing as an example, but I think it was like Lip Sync Battle got nominated in the same category. And I remember saying to myself, like, wait a minute, I'm fine losing to Antiques Roadshow, but not really. I'm fine losing to Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, but not really.
Right.
I'm fine losing to this one, but not really. But Jesus, I'm losing to a lip sync show that's right. not changing the world. So for a month, I actually made the decision that I wasn't going to make the show anymore.
Oh, wow.
I stopped. I was like, I'm done. Yeah. And it was very childish. It was like a kid who wants to take his ball and go home. So I went through the traditional sort of reality world reality, which is nobody really gives a shit.
Right.
At the end of the day, it's entertainment and nobody really cares. And if I'm doing it for that reason, I should stop. If I'm doing it for the right reasons, I should continue. And I had never been part of any sort of reality. And you know reality television better than anybody. It will eat you up and spit you out and mm-hmm. throw you on the side of the road and take the next number.
Yeah.
Nobody cares, you know? And I decided that I needed to figure out why I wanted to do it and how I was going to change it. And I really started to change the show. And I started doing different things, which is I went to Cuba and did a documentary there. I went to Puerto Rico after the hurricane. I wanted to go to Lebanon. And I wanted to change the narrative so deeply. And 2 years ago, or maybe it was more than that, when we ended up getting nominated for a Critics' Choice Award, it actually was the day that I actually felt like, okay, the people that really matter are the business owners.
Mm-hmm.
The people that really matter are the kids in high schools and in grade schools and in universities that are learning.
Yeah.
And the third bucket of people that I thought mattered were the educated journalists who studied this for a living.
Yeah.
Right. Who said, we are the people that see everything. We do this for a living. We're going to either refute or support the work, the craft that you make.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those very odd days. And we know that we'll never get nominated again for anything. And that's fine. It was one of those days. And I remember going to the Santa Monica, the airplane hangar place, you know, the airport
in
Santa Monica for the ceremony. And it was one of those days where I thought to myself, oh, my God, I don't feel like a reality person. I feel like an accomplished educator.
Oh, that's
I went
great.
From feeling like a TV personality to feeling like a professor.
You are a professor. You should know that.
Yeah, I try. I try to be more of a therapist than I do a professor, by the way.
Well, I think you're an educator. You really are. If you think about it, you really are. And that's what people tell me overwhelmingly about your show. They feel like they learned something. They feel empowered. And I don't think many shows do that. And I think that your humility and the fact that you're willing to be open about yourself and your weaknesses, that, you know, people really connect with that. I guess my last question is, you know, in the wake of the pandemic, small businesses are suffering, obviously. You know better than anybody what it's like to make it through to weather a storm. So what is your advice for people with small businesses right now who are terrified of the next few months? Maybe if not just the next few months, but the next year. And for what in their immediate future, what is your advice for them?
Well, before I give you the advice, I want to tell you what I think the prognosis is, if I can. And that is that every business isn't going to make it through. They're just not. There's no amount of money that stimulus funds could solve problems for. It's just, you can't throw money at everything and it's not just going to fix everything. And businesses that were unhealthy morally, unhealthy work ethic-wise, unhealthy structurally, aren't going to become healthy because the government throws a bunch of money at it. So that's number one. Number two, everybody isn't cut out to be a business owner. And the reality of it is that being a business owner is not a glamorous thing. And number three, I think people have to decide if they want to continue to be a business owner. Once those three things are thought through, I believe that businesses in America, not just small businesses, but businesses in America, are having to find out what the new normal is. How am I going to make a living? How do consumers' behavior change? What ultimately is going to be the biggest change? And if I look at the different silos of businesses that I have a bunch of little businesses, but they've all sort of landed in these larger silos. So I have my camping business, which I think will be a huge winner through this process because people aren't going to want to go on cruise ships and planes and things like that. I have a pet business that was born on the profit, 90 stores that I own, co-own with a husband and wife, who, by the way, I picked them simply because they adopt children. That's the only reason I picked their episode.
Wow.
I have a fashion business that was a conglomeration of a bunch of other little fashion stores. That's actually my wife's business now. And then I have food businesses. And as I look at those individually, I know for certain that there are certain businesses that are going to make it no matter what. Any health and wellness business, gyms, salons, manicures, pedicures, pet shops, because everybody loves their pets. There are certain things that I think make it no matter what. Recession, people may spend less, but they're not going to not feed their pet. They're maybe going to go get their hair colored four times instead of six times. They're going, you know what I mean? You're still going to do certain things. But there are other businesses that I worry about. And I worry about people's mindsets in changing. The problem is I only worry about it for about 5 minutes. And the reason that I say that is back in 2008-9, people worried. We worried about the same thing, and everybody got amnesia and started doing things again. So my advice to people is be sure that this is what you want to do. Don't blame anybody else for how you got to this place. Not going to solve anything. And number three, if you didn't have a good process before, or you didn't surround yourself with good people before, or you were selling some really bizarre product like an 8-track cassette player, this is the moment to either get in or get out. And if you're going to stay in, you got to pivot. And if you're going to pivot, you better do it fast. But we're a resilient country. And I've been spending the bulk of my time on social media just trying to keep people's heads screwed on straight. I do worry about it. And I know that I don't want to be the dark person in the room, but I do worry that I don't want to just be the ray of sunshine and act like everything's going to be back to normal in a month, because it's not going to be.
Yeah.
Here's what I am hopeful for and bright about. I am hopeful and bright that people will reinvent themselves. And if you are a good person and you understand who you are and you love other people and you love your family and you do right by people and you have a good work ethic, you're going to land on your feet no matter what. And so I have a new show that's starting that I had just finished shooting, by the way, that has not been announced yet, but I'll tell you about it, called Streets of Dreams. And I did it with ZPZ. Are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not.
So ZPZ produced Anthony Bourdain's show.
Oh, okay.
And when Anthony, terribly passed away, they wanted to reinvent something. And so we are launching a show, hopefully sometime this year, just depending on, when we get all the edits done and everything. But it is a show about the American dream and the corners of the country that it happens in. And the small shop owners. And it's really meant to uplift people. And by the way, it was formatted and shot before the pandemic, but it couldn't be any more timely to show people that whether you're an immigrant from Cuba and you land on Calle Ocho in Miami, or you are a Hasidic Jew and you're in the Diamond District in New York City, or you are a fisherman in San Diego, that there is a place for everybody in this country. And what I want to do is take the rest of my career on television and really just focus on building people up and protecting them. That's sort of what this whole pandemic has taught me. That's what I think the world needs of me. The world will tell me if they want that or not by tuning in or not tuning in. But I am very excited about the possibility to inspire people more going forward.
I'm so grateful for you, for your time, and for all that you do for people. I appreciate you spending the time with me. I think you're going to be really uplifting for a lot of people. This is a great message and so important. They can catch your show, of course, on demand on the CNBC website. The show is called The Prophet. It is excellent.
Tuesday nights at 10 o'clock, we always have something on. And then, you know, there's reruns all the time. I do appreciate you stalking me, because the more we can get our message out about helping people, the better. So you and I are helping people together.
I agree. Thank you so much. And where can they find you on social media?
Just under Marcus Lemonis, just at Marcus Lemonis on all of the handles. And right now I'm giving away RVs to healthcare workers across the country, so that when this is over, they can go see this wonderful country on my dime, not their dime. So it's been really exciting.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Marcus.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my incredible guest, Marcus Lemonis, and remind you that you can join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. You can talk about this episode, Wednesday's episode with Leah McSweeney, and all the other breaking reality and unscripted television news that are coming our way. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet during shows and about shows all week long, and I'm dying to know what you think of this interview. You can also find me on Instagram at Kate Casey, CA. I also have a Patreon page if you are looking for bonus episodes. Go to patreon.com/Kate Casey. And of course, if you could remember to just send me a 5-star review on iTunes. I'm wishing you all a great weekend. I'm looking forward to catching up with you next week. And please send me a note. Let me know who else you'd love to hear from.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.